In his heart, Mason has grown accustomed to the impossibility between Dixon and himself of affection beyond a certain enclosure. They have spent years together inside one drawn perimeter and another. They also know how it is out in the forest, over the coastal ranges, out of metropolitan control. Only now, far too late, does Mason develop a passion for his coadjutor comparable to that occurring between public school students in England. "Oh, please, Wick, spare us. Far too romantic, really," mutter several voices at once. Say then that Mason at last came to admire Dixon for his bravery, a different sort than they'd shown each other years before on the Seahorse, where they'd had no choice. Not quite the same as they'd both exhibited by the warrior path. Here in Maryland, they had a choice at last, and Dixon chose to act and Mason not to, unless he had to, what each of us wishes he might have the unthinking grace to do, yet fails to do. To act for all those of us who have so failed. For the sheep. Yet Mason offered his admiration, so long and unreasonably withheld, only to provide Dixon fodder for more rustic jokery. "All, pray thee, Mason, shall I have a special uniform for the, something with a cloak to it? Mantua length would be better, wouldn't it, than all the way down, for I would need access to my pistol." There, unavoidable in the street, is the slave driver, and he's driving about half his drove, who, through some inconvenient behavior, remain unsold. He is screaming, having abandoned all control, and striking everywhere with the whip, mostly encountering the air, even with the movements of the Africans limited by the chains, having failed to inflict much injury. "You fucked up my sale. You fucked up my day. You fucked up my business. Now I owe money, plus another night's lodging, plus another night's victualling. I'll just seek assistance then, shall I?" Mason making as if to flee. "Mason, thou art the only one nearby who knows how to watch my back. Would thou mind frightfully?" And before Mason can stir, Dixon is down the steps and into the street. "That's enough." He stands between the whip and the slaves with his hat back and his hand out. Later he won't remember how. "I'll have that." "You'll have it to your head, friend, if you don't step out of my way. These are mine. I'll do as I damn please with my property." Townsfolk pause to observe. Dixon, moving directly, seizes the whip. The owner comes after it. Dixon places his fist in the way of the oncoming face. The driver cries out and stumbles away. Dixon follows, raising the whip. "Turn around. I guess you've never felt this. You broke my tooth." "In a short while, that's not going to matter much, because in addition, I'm going to kill you. Now be a man, face me, and make it easier, or must I rather work upon you from the back like a beast, which will take longer and certainly mean more discomfort for you?" "No, please, my little ones. Oh, Tiffany, Jason. Any more?" "Soames." Dixon reaches down and tears from the man's belt a ring of keys. "Who knows where these go?" "We know them by heart, sir," replies one tall woman in a brightly striped headcloth. With the driver protesting the usefulness of his life, the Africans unchain themselves. "Now then," cries Dixon merrily. A not at all friendly crowd by now having formed, and as we're in the middle of town here, the Africans advise him, "Sheriff's men will be here any moment. Don't worry about us. Some will stay, some will get away, but you'd better go right now." Despite this sound counsel, Dixon still greatly desires to kill the driver, cringing there among the wagon ruts. What's a man of conscience to do? It is frustrating. His voice breaks. "If I see you again, you are a dead man." He shakes the whip at him. "And dead you'll be ere you see again this instrument of shame, for it will lie in a Quaker home and never more be used." "Don't bet the meeting house on that," snarls the driver, scuttling away. "Go back to Philadelphia," someone shouts at Dixon. "Good withdrawal line or two here yet," reports Mason. Thrusting the whip into his red coat, Dixon steps away, Mason following. At the first brick prow of a house to block them from view, they take to their heels, returning by a roundabout and not altogether witting route to the stable where their horses wait. "Hey, rebel old gal, I'm pleased to see your face." Dixon has brought a small apple from a fruitmonger's barrel, but the horse dives anyway beneath the giant flaps over his coat pockets and goes in to inspect, lest something should have been overlooked. At that moment of equine curiosity, with Mason occupied in saddling up, Dixon understands what Christopher Mayer must have meant long ago by instrument of God, and his obligation henceforward to keep silence upon the topic. They are very conscious of leaving town, with luck for the last time, observing everything as through some marvelous specs that make all come sharp and near. Sailors sit upon curbstones outside the front doors of the taverns that have intoxicated them, vomiting the surveyors on with a strange elation. Traffic in the street brings and takes its own light, lanterns upon carriages projecting in swooping shadows upon the crooked meridians and parallels of the brick walls, every leafless tree, every desire-driven pedestrian and street-wary dog. In low-ceilinged rooms at right angles to the street, wagon drivers stand in glum rows, drinking as if out of duty, protected from the snow that promises at any moment to begin, though from little else, least of all the road and its chances. Women pull their shawls in against the night. Young people, singly and paired, bound for twilight assignations, sweep up and down the steps of row houses and along the curbsides from which the steps rise in all the traceless promise of first lantern light. Now that the surveyors must leave, they wish to stay. In an onset of turning evil, Mason imagines the streets full of row houses multiplying like loaves and fishes, whirling past like spokes of a giant wheel, whose convergence or hub, beyond some disputable prelude to radiance, he cannot make out. They are soon enough upon the York Road, the deeply magnetized fields to either side, in the dark, tugging at bits, buckles, pen nibs, compass needles, and the steel strands of the driver's whip. They feel covered with small beings crawling and plucking everywhere, neither kindly remembrancers nor wicked spirits. "Do you feel that?" calls Mason in the dark. "You're the needle master. What is it?" "Mysteries of the magnetic." After a bit, "Aye, instances of those being..." "I don't know, Mason. 'Tis why I say mysteries." Lantern lights ahead. Soon they can hear a night congregation singing. Reaching a small wood, moon-colored chapel, as if by earlier arrangement, the surveyors pause to listen. "O God, in thy mercy, forever uncertain, upon whom continue thy sheep to rely, pray keep us till dawn, be the night ere so long, all thy helpless creation who sleep neath the sky." For the chances of night are too many to reckon, and the bridge to the daylight is ever too frail. When the hour of departure shall strike to the second, who will tend to the journey, who will find us the trail? As once were we lambs in a springtide abiding, as once were we children, eternal and free. So shepherd us through where the dangers be few, from darkness preserve us, returning to thee. Having acknowledged at the warpath the justice of the Indians' desires after the two deaths, Mason and Dixon understand as well that the line is exactly what Captain Zhang and a number of others have been styling it all along, a conduit for evil. So the year in Delaware, with the degree of latitude, is an atonement, an immersion in real science, a baptism of the Cypress Swamp, and even a rebirth. Not some hired cadastral survey by its nature corrupt, of use at trail's end only to those who would profit from the sale and division and resale of lands. Guineas, Mason, pistoles, and Spanish dollars splendorously vomited from Pluto's own gut, without end, all generated from that one line. Yet has any of it so much as splashed or dribbled in our direction? The one thing we do know how to do is vistos. Let's give them something they'll journey from other provinces, down rivers and pikes, in streams ever widening, to gaze upon. As the visto soon is lined with inns and shops, stables, games of skill, theatricals, pleasure gardens, a promenade, nay, mall, 80 miles long. At twilight, you could mount to a platform and watch the lamps coming on. Watch the visto tapering in perfect projection to its ever unreachable point. Pure latitude and longitude. "I am a student of blind Jack Metcalf, if it please you," declares one of the axemen, overhearing them. "West riding lad. Blind surveyor. He was famous in Staindrop even when I was a lad." Applying the methods I learned whilst a member of his crew, we could build a modern road here, straight up this visto, the 80 miles well-drained its entire length, self-compacting, impervious to all weather, immovable, neath laden wheels, be they broad or narrow. True, there's nothing much at the middle point, not today as we speak, but with the much improved carriage from the other end, itself convenient to Philadelphia, Newcastle, the entire heart of Chesapeake, why, a metropolis could blossom here among the fens of Natticoke that might rival any to the north. Cha, warns the Chinaman, think about it. Very well, yet right lines by minimizing distance are highly valued by some. Commanding officers, merchants, express riders, must these all be creatures of Sha? Without question, officers kill men in large numbers. Merchants concentrate wealth by beggaring uncounted others. Express riders distort and injure the very stuff of time. Then why not consider light itself as equally noxious, inquires Dixon, for doth it not move ever straight ahead? Ah, a gleam as likely madness as merriment appearing in his eye, and if it moves in some other way? Every survey would have to be rerun, cries Dixon. Eh, marvelous! Work for all the poor Dodd men till doomsday. Excuse me, sir, Mason addresses the geomancer, is this an article of common faith among the Chinese, which I must remedy my ignorance of, or but a crotchet of your own, I assume I may safely disregard? No wonder the Jesuits find you folk inconvenient. What's that you're writing? Looks like verse. My epitaph. Like to hear it? He wished but for a middling life, forever in betwixt the claims of lust and duty, so intricately mixed, to reach some happy medium, fleet as a golden beam, uncharted as St. Brendan's Isle, fugitive as a dream. Alas, 'twas not so much the years, as day by thieving day, with debts incurred and interest due, that dreams were sold to pay. Until at last but one remained, too modest to have worth, that yet he holds within his heart, as he is held in earth. That other tract across the border, perhaps nearly everything, perhaps nearly nothing, is denied him. Is that why I sought so obsessively death's insignia, its gestures and formulae, its quotidian gossip, all those awful days out at Tyburn, hours spent nearly immobile, watching stone carvers labor upon tomb embellishments, chip by chip? Was it all but some way to show my worthiness to obtain a permit to visit her, to cross that grimly patrolled line, that very essence of division? She only wishes me back in the stink of mills, mutton grease, hell clamor, lanterns all night, the people in subjection, the fouled wells of Painswick, Bisley, Stroud, styling it home. Oh, is there no deliverance? She accosts him one night, walking the visto. Seems sad, doesn't it? She chuckles. Trust me, Mopery, there are regions of sadness you have not seen. Nonetheless, you must come back to our vale, round to your beginning, well away from the sea and the sailors, away from the nets of imaginary lines. You must leave Mr. Dixon to his fate, and attend your own. You don't care for him, do you? If we are a triangle, then must I figure as the unknown side? Dare you calculate me? Dead reckon your course into the wilderness that is now my home, as my exile? Show by projection shapes beyond the meager prism of my grave? Do you have any idea of my sentiments? I think not. Mr. Dixon would much prefer you forget me. He is of beaming and cheery temperament, a boy who would ever be off to play. You were his playmate. Now that is over, and you must go back inside the house of your duty. When you come out again, he will no longer be there, and the dark will be falling. On their last visit to New York, at the very end, waiting for the Halifax packet, they dash all about the town, looking for any face familiar from years before. Yet they are berated for their slowness at corners. Carriages careen through puddles the size of ponds, spattering them with mire unspeakable, so that they soon resemble irregulars detached from a campaign in some moist country. The Sons of Liberty have grown even less hospitable, and there is no sign of Philip Dimdown, nor Blackie, nor Captain Volcano. Out of town, they are told, when they are told anything. Let's drink up and get out of here. There's no point. We can find them. That's what we do, isn't it? We're finders, after all. The continent is casting off, one by one, the lines that fastened us to her. Yet, at last, seated among their impedimenta, huge, unreckoned, stretching north and south into wood latticework, a deep, great thicket of spars, poised upon the sky, hemp and city smoke, two of a shed full of somberly cloaked travelers waiting the tide. They are aware once more of a feeling part intracranial, part skin quiver, part fear. Familiar from inns at bridges, waiting places at ferries, all lenses of revenants or haunting, where have ever converged to them images of those they drank with, saw at the edges of rooms from the corners of eyes, shouted to up or down a visto. This seems to be true now of every face in this place. Mason turns, his observing eye protruding in alarm. Are we at the right pier? I was just about to ask. I didn't actually see any signs, did you? They are approached by a gentleman not quite familiar to them. A slouch hat obscures much of his face. Well met, he pronounces, yet nothing further. Are ye bound for Falmouth? Mason inquires. For Pendennis Point, mean you, and Carrick Roads? His tone poises upon a cusp twixt mockery and teasing, which recognition might modulate to one or the other, yet neither can quite identify him. That Falmouth? There is another, sir. Dixon, maniotropic detectors a jingle, gets to his feet as Mason eyeballs the exits. There is a Falmouth invisible, as the center of a circle is invisible, yet with compasses and straight edge may be found, the stranger replies. At that instant, the company is roused by a great clamor of bells and stevedores as the packet, rigging a throb, prepares to sail. There will be perhaps 2 minutes to get aboard. We must continue this conversation at sea, and he has vanished in the commotion. Each day, on the way over, Mason and Dixon will look for him, at mess, at cards, upon every deck, yet without issue. Mason's last entry for September 11, 1768, reads, At 11:30 a.m., went on board the Halifax packet boat for Falmouth. Thus ends my restless progress in America, followed by a point and long dash that thickens and thins again, Chinese style. Dixon has been reading over his shoulder. What was mine then? Restful? Chapter 73. As all history must converge to opera in the Italian style, however, their tales, as commemorated, might have to proceed a bit more hopefully. Suppose that Mason and Dixon and their line cross Ohio after all and continue west by the customary 10-minute increments, each installment of the story finding the party advanced into yet another set of lives, another difficulty to be resolved before it can move on again. Behind, in pursuit, his arrangements undone, pride wounded, comes Sir William Johnson, played as a lunatic Irishman, riding with a cadre of close Indian friends, somehow, as if enacting a discarded draft of Zeno's paradox, never quite successful in attacking even the rearmost of the party stragglers, who remain ever just out of range. Yet at any time, we are led to believe, the pursuers may catch up and compel the surveyors to return behind the warrior path. Longer sights, easier grades, wider night skies as the landscape turns inside out, with groves upon the prairie now the reverse of what glades in the forest were, not so many chains ago. Far less axe work being required, soon the axemen are down to Stig alone, who, when asked to, becomes a one-man assault force on behalf of the astronomers. The music, from some source invisible, is resolutely merry, no matter what it may be accompanying. One late autumn, instead of returning to the coast, the astronomers will just decide to winter in, however far west it is they've got to. And after that, the ties back in to Philadelphia and Chesapeake will come to mean that much less, as the pair, detached at last, begin consciously to move west. The underlying condition of their lives is quickly established as the need to keep, as others, a permanent address, a perfect latitude. No fixed place, rather a fixed motion. Westering. Whenever they do stop moving, like certain stars in Chinese astrology, they lose their invisibility and revert to the indignity of being observed and available again for earthly purposes. Were they to be taken together, themselves light and dark sides of a single planet, with America the sun, an observation point on high may be chosen from which they may be seen to pass across a face serene and benevolent at that distance, though from the distance of the planet, often, winter is summer, harsh and inimical. Into the Illinois, where they find renegade French living out a fantasy of the Bourbon court, teaching the Indians dressmaking, millinery, wine growing, old cuisine, orchestral music, wig dressing, and other such arts of answering desire as may sustain this folly. They believe Mason and Dixon to be revolutionary agents. Descending great bluffs, they cross the Mississippi, the prehistoric mounds above having guided them exactly here, by an influence neither can characterize more than vaguely, but whose accuracy is confirmed by their star observations as nicely as the micrometer and nonius will permit. They stay at villages of teepees where Mason, as usual, behaves offensively enough to require their immediate departure. At a quite inconvenient time, too, for Dixon and his maiden of the day, who've both been looking forward to a few private moments. Instead, the astronomers spend the rest of their day running from the angry villagers, and only by fool's luck do they escape. They subsist upon roots and fungi. They watch lightning strike the prairie again and again, for days, and fires rage like tentacles of a conscious being, hungry and a roar. They cower all night before the invisible thunder of bison herds, smelling the animal dust, keeping ready to make the desperate run for higher ground. They acquire a sidekick, a French Shawanese half-breed renegado named Von Goli, whose only loyalty is to Mason and Dixon, though like the Quaker in the joke, they are not so sure of him. When they happen across an adventurer from Mexico and the ancient city he has discovered beneath the earth, where thousands of mummies occupy the streets in attitudes of living business, embalmed with gold divided so finely it flows like gum, it is Von Goli, with his knowledge of herbal formulae, who provides Mason and Dixon with the velocity to avoid an otherwise certain dissolution. Far enough west, and they have outrun the slowly branching seep of Atlantic settlement, and begun to encounter towns from elsewhere, coming their way with entirely different histories. Cathedrals, Spanish music in the streets, Chinese acrobats, and Russian mystics. Soon, the line's own vis inertiae having brought them up to speed, they discover additionally that 'tis it now transporting them. Right in the way of the visto, some evening at supper time, will appear the lights of some complete village, down the middle of whose main streets the line will clearly run. Laws continuing upon one side, slaves, tobacco, tax liabilities, may cease to exist upon the other, obliging sheriffs and posses to decide how serious they are about wanting to cross Main Street. Thanks, gentlemen. Slaves yesterday, free men and women today. You surveyed the chains right off 'em with your own. One week they encounter a strange tribal sect, based upon the worship of some celestial appearance none but the congregation can see. Hungry to know more about the beloved, ignoring the possibility of a negative result, recklessly do they prevail upon the gazers to search scientifically with their instruments for this god, and having found its position, to determine its motion, if any. It turns out to be the new planet, which, a decade and a half later, will be known first as the Georgian and then as Herschel, after its official discoverer, and more lately as Uranus. The lads, stunned, excited, realize they've found the first new planet in all the untold centuries since gazing at the stars began. Here at last is the career maker each has dreamt of at differing moments and of degrees of faith. All we need do is turn, cries Mason, turn eastward again, and continue to walk as we ever have done to claim the prize. For the first time, we may forget any obligations to the current sky. For praise God, his ways how strange, we need never work again. 'Tis to the mug's game and the fool's errand, 'tis a royal entrance at life's redotto, 'tis a Copley medal. Hey, Dixon amiably waves his hat. Which half do thou fancy, obverse or reverse? What? Mason frowning in thought. Well, I rather imagined we'd share the same side, a half circle each sort of thing. Yet by now they can also both see the western mountains ascending from the horizon like a very close, hitherto unsuspected second moon, the circumferenter daily tracking the slow rise in vertical angle to the tops of these otherworldly peaks. They are apt to meet men in skins, and Indians whose tongues none of the party can understand, and long strings of pack horses loaded with peltry, their flanks wet, their eyes glancing round blinders, inquiring. Survey sites go on now for incredible hundreds of miles, so clear is the air. Chainmen go chaining away into it, and sometimes never come back. They would be rediscovered in episodes to come, were the episodes ever to be enacted, did Mason and Dixon choose not to turn back to certain fortune and global acclaim, but rather to continue west, away from the law, into the savage vacancy ever before them. The Copley Medal, Dixon trying to get into the spirit of things. Attend me, nothing would lie beyond our grasp. We would be the king's own astronomers, living in a palace, servants to obey our desires. Weighty stipends, unlimited credit. Wenches, actresses, observing suits of gold lamé. Any time, day or night, you wanted, what do you people eat? Haggis? You want a haggis after midnight? All you need do is pull upon a bell cord and hi-ho. Bob certainly sold me, nods Dixon, gesturing with his broad hand at the sunset, which happens tonight to be wildly spectacular. Yet all those... Mason nods back impatiently. They will have to live their lives without any line amongst them, unseparated, daily doing business together, world's business and hearts alike, reprieved from the tyranny of residing either north or south of it. Nothing worse than that. What? How, then, should we never again come west? Should we ever be permitted to, either by the king or by the Americans? Think not, Lens Fellow. If we do turn and go back now, 'twill have to be a continental DIO forever. How Emerson will despise me. As you've already taken money from the Royal Society, isn't that, in his view, unredeemably corrupted? Thank ye, I'd nearly forgotten. Lethe passes to each and all, yet vivid in attention must the degree of our day's sinfulness be ever kept. Whatever did sinners do before there were those to tell them they were sinning? However blissful their ignorance, why, they suffered. Bollocks, they enjoyed themselves, Dixon mutters. I was there. Another expelled from paradise, another lad upon the north road, seeking his daily crumbs. Country folk they meet again are surprised to see them, sometimes shocked as at some return of the dead. Mothers drive their small ones like goslings away to safety. Barroom habitués reprove them at length. You weren't ever supposed to be back this way. Everyone said you'd done with all that to and fro by 68, left it to the other side of the Ohio, and would be westward from there and then on, for you two or nothing. We took yous in among us, allowed you to separate us, name us anew, only upon the understanding that you were to pass through each of our lives here but once. We believed you exactly that sort of visitor, not the other sort. We've enough of those here, the Lord knows, already. Indian, white, African, a swarm well before the twilight. We hardly need more. How dare you come back now? Among these consequences you have loosed like vermin, and so on. Babies take one look at them and burst into tears inconsolable. Boys but recently initiated to the ways of the rifle take playful shots at them. A recently wed couple assault them, screaming, "Yes, you came, the proper pair of bloody little cupids, didn't you? Then just went polka dancing away, leaving us to sort out his mother, the recruiting sergeant, the sheriff, the other girl. Whilst every lowlife you gentlemen caused to be sucked into town in your wake is ogling the Queen of Sheba here, who never could keep her eyes to herself, and say what you will, wife, my dear mother, has ever shown the born grace and sense of the true lady. Do you hear that, then, you miserable cow? Once again, as I've ever been telling all you scum, none of you's good enough for my boy Adolphus, especially not you, 15 stone of unredeemed slut. My gracious, just look at you. Bitch, the wife two-handedly swinging at her mother-in-law's head a great skillet, which none of the men present are hasty in rushing to deflect. The older woman dodges the blow and from somewhere produces a dirk. In a moment, someone will have to load and prime a pistol. All this having resulted from the award-winning Love Laughs at a Line episode, which seemed but light-hearted frolic that first time through. In the next village east, the creature they thought they had so rationally and with up-to-date methods proved to be but a natural phenomenon has re-emerged, and holds in its sinister emprise the lives of that half of the populace living upon one side of the line. Yet for some reason, it is reluctant to cross and continue its depredations upon the other. The line is believed to present some barrier, invisible but powerful enough to hold back the being, to preserve those across it from the fate of their former neighbors. Brave townsfolk slip out after dark, dig up and move the boundary stones as far as they dare, some one way, some another. The line through here soon loses all pretense to orthogony, becoming a record in oolite of fear, whose and how much, and of how a village broke in two. In some towns, they are obliged to turn back westward, often waiting until dark to creep cautiously eastward again, for the population will hear of them in no other way but westering. When it seems there's a chance that someone may listen, Mason and Dixon both try to explain about the new planet, but very few care. It breaks slowly upon the astronomers that with no time available for gazing at anything, this people's indifference to the night and the stars must work no less decisively than their devotion to the day and the earth for whose sake something far short of the sky must ever claim them. A stove, a child, a henhouse predator, a deer upwind, the price of corn, a thrown shoe, an early freeze. At last, the post-marked West appears. A joint delegation from the American and Royal Societies, alerted by Jesuit telegraph, is there to greet them. A new and iridescent generation of Philadelphia beauties in full susurrus and chirp line both sides of the visto. A consort of crumhorns is on hand, playing airs and marches. Is the ineluctable moment of convergence. Will somebody repent ere they arrive? When they reach the postmarked west, one swerves a bit north and the other south of it, and on they go, together, up the east line to the shore of Delaware, into a boat and across, dropping by that day to visit the McLeans at Swedesboro. Heard some tales, gents. What'll yous do now? Devise a way, Dixon replies, to inscribe a visto upon the Atlantic Sea. Archie, lad, look ye here, Mason producing a sheaf of papers, flapping through them. A thoughtful enough arrangement of anchors and buoys, lenses and lanterns, forming a perfect line across the ocean, all the way from the Delaware Bay to the Spanish Extremadura, with the solution to the question of the longitude thrown in as a sort of bonus, as exactly at every degree might the sea line, as upon a fiduciary scale for navigators, be prominently marked by a taller beacon or a differently colored lamp. In time, most ships preferring to sail within sight of these beacons, the line shall have widened to a sea road of 1,000 leagues, as up and down its longitude blossom wharves, chandleries, inns, tobacco shops, greengrocer's stalls, printers of news, dens of vice, chapels for repentance, shops full of souvenirs and sweets, all a sailor could wish. Indeed, many such will decide to settle here, along the beacons, for good, as a way of coming to rest whilst remaining out at sea. A good, clean, salt-scoured old age. Too soon, word will reach the land speculation industry, and its bureaus seek purchase, like some horrible seaweed, the length of the beacon line. Some are estopped legally, some are fended directly into the sea, yet time being ever upon their side, they persist. And one day, in sinister yet pleasing coral-dyed cubical efflorescence, appears St. Brendan's Isle, a combination pleasure grounds and pensioner's home, with everything an itinerant come to rest might ask. Taverns, music halls, gaming rooms, and a population ever-changing of practitioners of comfort, to soul as to body, uncritical youngsters from far-off lands where death might almost abide, so ubiquitous is it there, so easily do they tolerate it here. Is here Mason and Dixon will retire, being, after all, plank holders of the very scheme, having written a number of foresighted stipulations into their contract with the line's proprietor, the transnoctially chartered Atlantic Company. Betwixt themselves, neither feels British enough anymore, nor quite American, for either side of the ocean. They are content to reside like ferrymen or bridge keepers, ever in a ubiquity of flow, before a ceaseless spectacle of transition. Part 3. Last Transit. Chapter 74. Perhaps all was as simple as that. that Dixon wished to remain and Mason did not, could not. So Dixon returned as well, and on 15 December 1768, at a meeting of the Royal Society Council, according to the Minute Book, there they are, together in the room. Both have chosen to wear gray and black. Monsieur Mason and Dixon, attending with proposals relative to the aforesaid intended observations, were called in. And Mr. Dixon acquainted the council that he was willing to go to the North Cape or Cherry Island. Mr. Mason rather declined going, but added that if he was wanted, he should be ready to go. Was their appearance all pro forma? Did Dixon know? Did they have it all worked out beforehand? Or was it sprung upon him, and thus less forgivable than the accustomed Masonical behavior? The meaner of spirit might translate it into, "Of course I'll go, but not with Dixon." A clear insult, Dixon was often advised. Would he not care to respond? "I've grown so used to it," Dixon assured his comforters, "that often I neglect to take offense." Privately, his sentiments are of a more hopeful turn. He knows enough of Mason to recognize by now most of the shapes his pursuit of the gentlemanly takes on, as well as the true extent of his progress beyond the socially stumbling philosopher fool he began as. That is, 'tis possible that Mason, honestly believing Dixon ready for, as deserving of, his own command, is willing to risk looking ungracious if it will advance that end. And so this "rather decline, yet if I am wanted" formula is but more of his inept kindness. They leave together, out into another Christmastide, each for his own reason seeking the brightest lights. Some horrible Boswell pursues them, asking questions. Known, of course, as the reluctant lensman of the Cape expedition to observe the first transit of Venus in 61, and despite the generally excellent quality of your work, neither of you has been voted to membership in the Royal Society. Mr. Mason, we've heard you're the one here who's unhappy with that, whilst Mr. Dixon takes the more philosophical view. Only the long view, lad. How could the elder Charles have forgiven Mason for leaving his children with his sister, dumping them really, going off to the Indies with another man, another stargazer, coming home only to turn about and sail off to America with the same man? Dixon sees the pattern, the expectation, the coming transit of Venus. Mason sees it too. If we went off a third time together, he hates me enough already. I study the stars against my father's wish. But do I remain among them only at the price of my sons? That is what I face, some choice. So he declines the North Cape and another posting together, symmetrically as ever, to that end of the world lying opposite their first end of the world. Someone must break this damned symmetry, Mason mutters. For years, as he found his way further into the walled city of melancholy, he dreamed, though presently no longer sure if he had been asleep or awake, of the North Cape he would never see, an unexpectedly populous land where the native people were enslaved by a small but grimly effective European team, quartered and mostly restricted to an area within easy reach of their boats, upon which, indeed, many of them preferred to sleep. The only industry there was mining the guano of the seabirds and shipping it to lower latitudes to be processed into nitre for gunpowder, which was in great demand, as it seemed that far below, a general European war had broken out for dynastic, racial, and religious reasons Mason and Dixon, who was also in the dreams, realized they were ignorant of, having been out of touch with any kind of periodical news for 8 or 9 years now. They arrived at the North Cape to find the mines working day and night shifts, and the mood turning unpleasant as white overseers demanded more and more from workers who were not making enough for it to matter what the warring nations below did to each other, nor on what schedule. The guano deposits, and hence the mining, were upon rocks off the coast, often quite far out to sea, where the light was crepuscular and clear. The guano was carried out to the ships in scows of soaked, black, failing timbers. Loading these vessels directly from the rocks was perilous work. Weather often swept in, carrying away ships and souls. The natives, who were dark-skinned and spoke none but their own tongue, deserted when they could, and many times contrived their own deaths when all else had failed to deliver them. At Maskelyne's behest, Mason agrees to observe the transit from South Ulster, where he obtains the ingress of Venus upon the disk of the sun, but not her departure. The mists rise up out of the bog. There she is, full, spherical. The last time I shall see her as a material being. When next appearing, she will have resumed her deity. Maskelyne will edit this out, which is why Mason leaves it in his field report. Shall Ireland be his last journey out, his last defiance of Sapperton, which is to say, Rebecca? There's no place for him in London. The city has never found his heart, and 'tis his heart that keeps a residue of dislike for the place ever guarded. Likewise, must he allow himself to let go of Dixon soon now? He sees nothing but penance ahead, and renunciations proceeding like sheep straggling back, gathering to shelter. He sits alone in brand new rooms of which he may be the very first occupant, in the smell of plaster and paint and glue, the paper upon the walls an assault of color, indigo, cochineal red, Spanish orange, the often observed magenta and green, the day outside unable to emerge from morning. Rebecca, whom he expects to visit, does not appear. He waits, trying to see his way ahead, suddenly 16 again. He tries to think of how, short of suicide, he may put himself in her way. He is furious about everything. He screams at length about transient setbacks, however slight. Misses his family, the servants tell it. No sleep. The house is large, inexpensively Palladian, with beds in every room, not only the parlor and the drawing room, but the kitchen and the music conservatory as well. Shadows are everywhere unpredictable. Mason tries each room in turn. Other guests are out upon the same pilgrimage. They meet in the halls and mutter civilities. In the music room, he wakes during the night and mistakes the clavier for a coffin with somebody in it, withal, who may or may not be another sleeper. Out in the bogs, fairy lights appear. He hears a note from the cased instrument, then another. He much prefers the kitchen or the observatory out back. There he is hypnagogically instructed all night long in the arts of silent food preparation, the sandwich having found here a particular admiration for the virtual soundlessness of its assembly. In a letter dated November 9th, close to Mason's departure from Donegal, Maskelyne, as AR, is wallowing in the pleasure of good instruments to work with at last. The defective bob suspension is now but a distasteful pang of memory, causing him at his morning shave to grunt and avoid his eyes in the mirror. The sector telescope he finds charming. I have also used a 10-foot telescope with a micrometer. Your moral reflections on the subject I approve of, as becoming an astronomer who ought to make this use of these sublime speculations. What was he talking about? In Maskelyne's letter, which we have, he says he's responding to a letter of Mason's dated October 15th, which no one can locate, including me. Indeed, I've not found any of Mason's letters, though there are said to be many about. Make something up, then, Munchausen would. Not when there exists somewhere a body of letters Mason really did write. I must honor that, mustn't I, Brother Ives? Ives snorts and chooses not to contend. Why not gamble they'll never be found, wonders Ethelmer. Just because I can't find them doesn't mean they're not out there. The question may be, rather, must we wait till they are found to speculate as to the form moral reflections upon a 10-foot telescope with a micrometer might take? The presence of this device, as well as the instrument's length, suggests an accuracy to perhaps 2 further degrees of magnitude than the instrument it replaced at Greenwich. Sublime speculations, accuracy and sublimity? Is the AR being ironical? Whatever Mason had to say almost certainly included God. Was he off the deep end again? Make this use, suggests Mason, had advanced some program. Suppose he had written to Maskelyne, "'Tis the reciprocal of as above, so below, being only at the finer scales that we may find the truth about the greater heavens. The exact value of a solar parallax of less than 10 seconds can give us the size of the solar system." The parallax of Sirius, perhaps less than 2 seconds, can give us the size of creation. May we not, in the domain of 0 to 1 second of arc, find ways to measure even that which we cannot, may not see? Many of us, in the parsonical line of work, admits Wicks Cherrycoke, find congenial the mathematics, particularly the science of the fluxions. Few may hope to have named for them, like the Reverend Dr. Taylor, an infinite series. Yet such steps, large and small, in the advancement of this most useful calculus, have provided us a rackful of tools for analysis undreamed of even a few years ago. Though some must depend upon epsilonics and infinitesimalisms and other sorts of defective zero. Is it the infinite that tempts us, or the imp? Or is it merely our vocational habit, ancient as Kabbalah, of seeking God there among the notation of these resonating chains? Reminds me of America. Strange, some mornings I get up and I think I'm in America. Half mountain, half bog, every other soul in it named O'Reilly, Oak boys with night mischief in mind all about, this is frontier country again, standing betwixt Ulster and the Dublin Pale, whilst of neither. Poor, at the mercy of landowners, such as Lord Pennycumquick, the global communications nabob, who now approaches Mason upon the lawn, carrying in coat pockets the size of saddlebags 4 bottles of the cheap claret everywhere to be found here, thanks to enterprising Irishmen in Bordeaux. In my family since the second Charles, he calls in greeting. Isn't 100 years considered old for wine? Mason, having risen kickish this morning. Oh, but I meant the coat, Pennycumquick having decided, with legions before him, that Mason, because he speaks in the hurried and forced rhythms of at least a tickler of children, is a professional wag of some sort. Aye, 'tis called a morning coat, the yellow symbolizing the sun, I imagine. Several theories about these aqua bits here, examining them the way we examine our waistcoats for spilled food, being, of course, our famous historically subversive color green. Should have been a hanging offense as long ago as Robin Hood, if you ask me, yet disguised cleverly, you see, by the addition of blue. Perhaps a touch of buff as well. Ah, ha, ha, do not look so concerned, sir, being all Whigs here, staunch and true. Yes, well, do come along. Ye've not seen the folly yet, have ye? What cannot escape Mason's notice as they come round the butt end of the topiary elephant is a sudden vista of obelisks, arranged in a double row too long to count, forming an avenue leading to the folly. In this sunlight they have withdrawn to the innocence of stone, into being only here enough to maintain the effect of solemn approach. Yet it isn't hard for Mason to imagine them in less certain light, at a more problematic time of day, taking on more human shape. Almost human shape, somewhat larger than human size, almost able to speak. There it is. What do you think? The Lord has halted, pockets asway to help Mason admire it, this being a task inadvisable for but one person. You can't say it isn't something, is Mason's comment. Of course, if you've read Mr. Halfpenny's Rural Architecture and the Chinese Taste, you'll recognize those bits there at the roof corners. Our great Buddha, half-scale, regrettably. Here, therapeutic pool, peat baths. Good morning, Rufus. I trust your good woman has recovered. Excellent. She ran that department, chaos, since she left. Ah, the electric machines. Yes, a good many of them. All the way down to the end there. Can you make it out? On the rare chance you have an appetite when you emerge, lo, a summer kitchen, complete with gesticulating chef. Yes, yes, soup du jour, Armand. Clever fellow, claims to know you, as a matter of fact. Mr. Mason, Mr. Mason. Is the very Frenchman, is it not? Yet why, then, is his figure illuminated so much less than everything else about this time of day? Why is he moving so smoothly, as a boat upon still water, looming ever closer, aiming, it now becomes apparent, a kiss at Mason's cheek? His color at close range aberrating toward green, as he sweeps in a cold wind upon and past the shivering Mason with an echo like an odor trailing after. Mason turns. The lawn is empty. At some moment, he has failed to mark, Lord Pennycumquick has left him. He stands by an oven with moss between its stones that he wishes upon no account to look into. The rain has raised in everyone an insomniac apprehension in which all talk of bog bursts is avoided. Yet 'tis but a question of where the black flood shall break through. The longer it rains, the higher, too, the level of nerves and vapors. No one here or for miles will need to be awakened for it. At last, one midnight. Bog burst, out upon MacIntaggart's piece. Good evening to you, sir, and regretfully must I now be telling you, ye've been, as they say in your Royal Navy, impressed, sir. Oh, I am impressed, Mason agrees. Really, The efficiency with which you are able to turn all these wretches to is nothing short of impressive, indeed. Excuse me, sir. 'Tis me English, no doubt. I meant that you, too, must come out and work in the company of these very wretches. Of course. Man of science, ever happy to advise. Restoring the berm, is that how we'll be at it? Some day, when all's calm, I'd love to chat over with you the finer points of bog-burst management. Yet now would I suggest boots and gloves, sir, and smartly, too, if he'd not be mindin'. Little McTiernan at the door is giving out short-handled peat-cutters, styled by the Irish Slanes. Not sure I know how to cut a sod, mumbles Mason. Quickly's best, before he can pick up a weapon. Let him be, Dermy. Not his fault he's English. Boggs, Mason to himself, as they go along, bearing candles and hollowed-out turnips, not certain if he is speaking aloud, are my destiny. I imagine Delaware, not merely the end, but years past the end, of this sort of journeyman's humiliation. Even fancied that I had earned passage, at last, into a purer region, where Mathesis should rule, with nothing beyond an occasional ink smudge to recall to me that unhappy American station of the cross. Arr! Stars and mud, ever conjugate, a paradox to consider, one for the astronomer royal, perhaps. His current scheme being to assail masculine sanity by now and then posing him questions that will not bear too much cogitating upon. Most lately, Uber Bernulis Rockisto Kranzproblem, 17-2, by Baron von Bopdorfer. Mind like a Spanish blade. Read it at the risk of your self-esteem, having almost done the trick. Slodging the wet tracks, dressed all in the local frieze, Mason, by neap lantern light, looks like a wet, truculent sheep. The rain comes down. They cross the river, passing round Kiadu and Kinnipottle, where more come creeping from sleepless dwellings to join them. Mason might be traveling with a herd of ghosts, felt but invisible, bearing him into country unknown. The sky tonight has nothing to show him. Now and then, very much closer to the earth, he begins to see lights, moving, flickering, soon gone. Who are they? Mason inquires of his faceless companions. Hush, come a half-dozen voices at once. They are going their way as we go ours, whispers someone behind his right ear. They are not often out in the rain, nor particularly helpful in a slide. Soon they have reached one shore of the liquefied peat flow, through some mirage blacker than the neighboring night. McIntaggart's been after that tath for a year, and now 'tis his for nothing. He kept still, and the premises moved. Look out, here comes more of it. What, a repeat? In Irish perversity, all aquip, they set to work finding and cutting out peat sods not yet saturated by the rain. Other countrymen appear now and then, bearing rocks, piling them laboriously against the burst through the drizzling of the night. Cottagers, dazed, come wobbling down the hill. Dawn finds the tops of the hillsides obscured, each shiftmate a wan specter in the vaporous bog. Mr. Mason? Your servant, sir. 'Tis the well of St. Brendan, if you please. Thought he was a Galway lad. No, he passed through Cavan once, on his way to the sea, looking for crew, and from the spot where he slept came forth the very water they drank in Eden, so lovely is it to taste. Now, in the general relocation, has it vanished? Though we've dowsers aplenty, yet all are in perplexity, not to mention humility, in begging the application of your London arts in discovering and restoring it. I've the very thing, Mason replies. Among his equipment at the Pennycumquick Manor is the crease from his dream in Cape Town, which he has kept ever by him. Have you water from this spring? He pours and rubs it over the blade, returning to the bog burst, where immediately he senses a traction, a warmth, a queer high whine along the blade, though 'tis none of these. Here, I believe. He helps them to dig. At no great depth, a spring is encountered, whose perimeter is quickly shored against recollapse. One by one, country folk taste the water. Some say it is the very spring of the saint. Others say it isn't. In fact, there is so wide a difference of opinion that presently what will be the first of many blows are exchanged. In an ordinary dream, Rebecca appears. No need to feel pleased with yourself. What you found was not their sacred well, but only a representation of it. He wakes up into a midnight sadness, trying to say, I have tasted it, yet he has not tasted it. Now he is afraid ever to, lest his spring be discovered as soiled as the holy wells of Gloucestershire, and therefore the crease, and therefore his dreams. He prays to see her face in the new comet, each night, this time, in terror of not seeing it. He tries to will it there, yet is amazed that for some minutes now he cannot even remember her face. Yet at last arrives a clear night of seeing, so clear, in fact, that sometime after midnight, supine in the starlight, rigid with fear, Mason experiences a curious optical readjustment. The stars no longer spread as upon a domed surface. He now beholds them in the third dimension as well, the eye creating its own Z-axis, along which the star-choked depths, near and far, rush both inward and away, and soon, quite soon, billowing out of control. He collects that the heavenly dome has been put there as protection, in an agreement among observers to report only what it is safe to see. 15 years in the business, and here is his initiation. Now, nothing in the sky looks the same. As to the comet, I cannot account for how, but there came this night, to this boggy, miasmatic place, an exceptional clarity of the air, a sort of optical tension among the stars that seemed ever just about to break radiantly through. And there, in Leo, bright-maned, lo, it came. It came ahead, and would be but prelude to the finger of Corsica, which now appeared, pointing down from heaven. And the place where it pointed was the place I knew I must journey to, for beneath the sky-born index lay, as once beneath a star, an infant that must again remake the world. And this time 'twas a sign from earth, not only from heaven, showing the way. Quite so, yet I'm not terribly sure this ought to be in your report, says Mastline. Objections from the clergy. Readily imagined, what? Leaving aside a question of actually, well, what does it mean? No idea. I was in a kind of daze. Have you never fallen into one of those cometary dazes, with the way the object grows brighter and brighter each night? These apparitions in the sky we never observe but in motion, gone in seconds, and if they return, we do not see them. Once safely part of the night sky, they may hang there at their pleasure, performing whatever in their work corresponds to shifting jibs and staysails, keeping perfectly upon station, mimicking any faint, unnamed star you please. Do they watch us? Are they visits from the past, from an age of faith, when miracles still literally happened? Are they agents of the absented guardian? And are these its last waves, last beckonings, over the tops of the night trees? An astronomer in such a state of inquiry is apt to write nearly anything. How about yourself? Of course, there are things one wishes to leave in, often yearns to. Then again, there are things one leaves in. Wondrous. Let's strike the passage by all means. Now, what about the part round July where I compare the aurora borealis to gelled blood? Do you want that out, too? I was just coming to that. They've been frightfully picky of late about that word. No one knows why. What, blood? Well, too bloody bad, isn't it? The octagonal room echoes with indignation, imperfectly mocked. Bloody hell, now ye come to it. Maskline looks about nervously. Pray ye, Mason, there's ever someone listening. What of it? You are the AR, are you not? Tell 'em bugger off. He receives a long look from Maskelyne he can't recall ever having seen before. 'Tis not the same office as it was in Bradley's day, and your own. There will never more be disputes like this current one over his obs. 'Tis said it may run on for years. His obs. Mason, who performed many of these observations himself, and is consequently in the middle of the quarrel, snorts, but does not charge. Instead of the old arrangements, we've now a sort of contract, rather lengthy one, indeed, in return for this. Gesturing round, yet keeping his elbow bent, as if unable to extend his arm all the way, they own my work, they own the products of my thinking, perhaps they own my thoughts unuttered as well. I am their mechanical cuckoo, perched up here in this airy cage to remind them of the first day of spring, for they are grown strange, this cohort, to the very wheel of seasons. I am allowed that much usefulness, the rest being but drudging captivity. Difficult life. "Excuse me, what's this thing where the astronomer's couch used to be?" Is styled by the knowing Apesh Mortel, one of Mr. Chippendale's. Elegant, don't you think? Clive bought it for me, defiantly, the small eyes tightening for some assault, the lips remaining steady. "Who, Clive of India?" is all Mason says. "I meant for the observatory, of course," replies Maskline. "What would you do with mortal sin, when you wouldn't know it if it came over and bought you a pint?" "I have learned to simulate it, however, by committing a greater than usual number of the venial ones." Mason, trying not to stare too openly, has just realized that Maskline, direct from the astronomer's couch, is wearing his favorite observing suit, a garment of his own design that his brother-in-law, the famed Clive of India, sent him from Bengal, where the Nabob had had it cut and sewn with painstaking fidelity to a 30-page list of instructions from Maskline. It is a three-piece affair, everything quilted, long jacket, waistcoat, and trousers, which have feet at the ends of them, all in striped silk, a double stripe of some acidic rose upon celadon for the trousers and waistcoat, and for the jacket whose hem touches the floor when, as now, he is seated, a single stripe of teal blue upon the same color, which is also that of the revere. It is usually not wise to discuss matters of costume with people who dress like this, politics or religion being far safer topics. The suit, Mason knows, is but one of a collection of sportive outfits from the Royal Astronomical Armoire, run up to Maskelyne's increasingly eccentric specifications by the subcontinental genius Mr. Deep and his talented crew, and shipped to him express by East Indiamen, the third fastest thing on the planet, as Munn liked to say, behind light and sound. Neville seems to miss the life, sleeping or drinking in the daytime, starting to come alive around dusk, quickening with the evening shift. He and Mason pace about, the window-lensed afternoon sun heightening the creases beneath their chins amid motes of wig powder drifting in the glare of the beams. He exhibits a morally battered air and is not shy about discussing its origins.